Welcome, everyone, to the Revolution 250 podcast. I'm Bob Allison, the chair of Rev250's advisory committee. Revolution 250 is a consortium of 60-plus organizations looking to commemorate the story of the American Revolution here in Massachusetts. And we're really happy today to have with us Stephen Brumwell, who's joining us from Amsterdam. And Mr. Brumwell was a journalist on newspapers in the UK, and then he earned his PhD in history from the University of Leeds. And since then, he has written three extraordinary books on telling the story of British North America during the time of the Revolution. His first, Redcoats, looks at the British and American soldiers during the Seven Years' War, and his book on George Washington as a gentleman warrior is a new look at a figure we know very well. And his most recent book is Turncoat, which tells the story of Benedict Arnold. So thank you for joining us, Mr. Brumwell.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So what drew you to the story of Benedict Arnold?
Well, you mentioned just a moment ago that I used to work as a newspaper man. So I guess I've always been curious about kind of digging into the background of stories rather than just accepting what is the kind of the accepted version of events. Now, that interest combined with my long-standing interest in history itself, I think if you put those two together, you've got the desire really to try and find out, okay, here's a guy who's got this reputation as the worst traitor in American history, one of the worst traitors in world history, yet, you know, what was it all about? What made him tick? What kind of guy was he? Is there any way that by going back to the kind of the original source material and doing a bit of kind of journalistic digging combined with the levels of academic historical research, is there any way you can come up with a new angle on the old story?
And let me ask then, what is the new, what did you come up with a new angle on the story of Arnold?
Well, I think I did, and it's really a question of nuance, if you like. I mean, I can't pretend that I've found facts that change the basic narrative, but I think the key for me was, why did Arnold do what he did?
Yes.
And that was what I was interested in getting to the bottom of. And I think on that central question, I think I have been able to come up with a valid alternative to this, what has for a long time been the accepted standard explanation for his behavior. So, but my findings on that, which I can talk about, of course, in more detail in due course, my findings there were very much based on documents which hadn't been used before,
Yes. But
which began to fit in to a picture that I'd already started to build, which to me, in my own mind, these documentary finds, if you like, were pieces of the jigsaw that consolidated ideas I was already, conclusions I was already starting to move towards.
Yes. I think it was something of a mystery at the time because we Americans forget how important Arnold was and that he was so close to Washington. And this is why it so struck Washington, that if Arnold has betrayed us, who can we trust? And I think that's a piece that's hard for us to fathom now. And it makes it as you say, it's a puzzle we're trying to put together. And we've come up with. So anyway, could you talk a little bit more?
Sure. Sorry, Bob.
Go on.
Yeah. What you mentioned about Arnold's reputation, not least in the eyes of George Washington himself. And of course, we know Washington wasn't a man to suffer
no.
fools. And his high opinion, I should say, of Arnold was based upon reality, the service that Arnold had actually put in
Yes. In
the field. It was based on Arnold's concrete achievements. So for a man like Arnold, who Washington admired, to turn traitor at the very moment when the fortunes of war, the fortunes of the Revolutionary War, hung in the balance in 1780, mm-hmm. was a real hammer blow to Washington. And of course, Washington was also a very self-contained man. He wasn't someone who gave free rein to his emotions, and he tended to button himself down. So when Washington finally was made aware of the treason of Benedict Arnold on the day, on the 25th September 1780, on the morning of that day, then, you know, he kind of kept his emotions under control. And so really, you know, you mentioned the comment, "Who can we trust now?" That comes from Lafayette's memoirs, which were written many years later. Yes. And it's possible Washington did say something similar to that. Yes. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's this idea of who can we trust if Arnold, you know, that kind of champion of the cause of liberty, twice wounded, you know, mm-hmm. crippled, fighting the British, the fearless Arnold, who the men will follow anywhere, yes. if he betrays us, who can we trust? So that's a very good point. And Arnold's reputation by 1780 was very, very high, not only amongst the Patriots, but amongst the British also. The British, mm-hmm. Of all the American, of all the Patriot commanders, Arnold was one of those who they held in the highest esteem. Like Arnold's fellow Americans, the British were impressed by what they called his intrepidity, his courage. You know, anyone who was a soldier, didn't matter what coat you were wearing, could appreciate those kind of qualities, and they were ungrudging in their approval of the way he behaved on the battlefield and the kind of courage and endurance that he had displayed since mm-hmm. 1775.
Yes, yes. So you say it is, we know, a nuanced reasoning. It's not simply that he ran into debt in Philadelphia or that Congress was nasty to him, but it's a combination of different factors. And he also seemed really upset with the French alliance. And this is a particular moment. You know, Washington's going to meet with Rochambeau, and at the same moment that Arnold is planning to surrender West Point. You know, without getting too much bogged down in details, I wonder if you can just give us broadly what's happening. What is this plan that Arnold is going, by which Arnold's going to betray West Point?
Yeah, well, the whole West Point plan, really, if we just go back to the previous year, Arnold first approached the British in May 1779. So basically, by May 1779, for whatever reasons, he was disenchanted, disillusioned with the Patriot cause. He thought that the cause for which he'd signed up so enthusiastically in the spring of 1775, and he was one of the first to get out there into the field, had somehow lost its way. He approached the British. When he first approached the British, there was no talk of West Point. There was no, interestingly enough, there was no talk of being paid for going over to the British. He went over to the British, and one of the things he cited, according to Sir Henry Clinton, who was the British commander in chief at that time, and Clinton's recollection is quite soon after the event, he said, writing back to the ministry in London, that Arnold had approached him because one of the things he was particularly disenchanted about was the French alliance. Going back further, Arnold was born in 1741 in Connecticut, Norwich in Connecticut. At this time, Britain was at war with Spain, the so-called War of Jenkins' Ear. This morphed into the War of the Austrian Succession. And from that period onwards, for the next kind of 20-odd years, Britain and her North American colonies, of which Arnold, of course, was an inhabitant, were at war with France or with the Bourbon powers. 1757, Arnold himself was called out in the militia when the French came and captured Fort William Henry in upstate New York. So the point I'm trying to make here is that for Arnold and the men of his generation and the slightly older, including George Washington, of course, it was the French who were the natural enemy. So for Arnold, he joins the revolutionary cause in 1775, and he maintained that he enlisted, if you like, for what he calls the redress of grievances, which were basically he wanted to put the clock back to 1763, which was the end of the war in which Britain and her American colonies had defeated the French, kicked them out of Canada. He wanted to put the clock back to then, which was before the whole system of legislation, taxation, different policies that were introduced by the British to try and claw back some of the cost of winning that war. So at this stage, Arnold is basically saying he's not looking for independence necessarily. He's looking for a restoration of the status quo, a reunification of the British Empire, which is Britain's Atlantic Empire, under the old system. So there's certain ironies here, because Arnold is crippled at the battles of Saratoga, the Second Battle of Saratoga, and one of the consequences of Saratoga in the autumn of 1777 is the fact that the French, instead of just supplying the American rebels with guns, money, that kind of aid, decide to physically commit themselves as allies of the rebels, which means bringing in French soldiers, more importantly, actually bringing in French warships into the struggle, transforming the struggle into a global conflict. So Arnold is actually, as much as anyone, perhaps more than anyone else, is instrumental in bringing the French in on the side of the American rebels. So it is somewhat ironic that within a year or so, when the French alliance is actually being formalized, the British send out a peace commission to try and preempt the French alliance, the Carlisle Commission. And we know from Arnold's subsequent comments that he was in favor of the kind of terms that were being put forward by the Carlisle Commission. So I think the timing of this is quite interesting, and it ties into that point you made about, you know, the importance of French intervention. And Arnold wasn't alone in this. Quite a few officers in the Continental Army were of the opinion that this was business that Americans should finish on their own, and it was disgraceful that they were having to rely upon the intervention of a foreign power, especially the French, who had been the traditional enemy of the citizens of Britain's American colonies. So Arnold, when he approached the British in May 1779, according to Sir Henry Clinton again, and there's no reason to doubt what Clinton says, he has no motivation for coming up with some cockeyed theory on this. He said that Arnold talked about delivering his countrymen, and what he meant by that was delivering them from the horrors of what was seen by many, and in fact what was, to a large extent, a civil war, and something which by that stage seemed to have just kind of run into a stalemate where it just seemed pointless, a futile conflict. And I think it's also important to remember, and this is something which isn't always appreciated, that there was an awful lot of apathy at this time in the former colonies, now the states. The Continental Army was tiny. Maybe just 10,000 men, which is a tiny proportion of the available manpower. A lot of people were just waiting to see what would happen. So there was a lot of disillusionment. And if you combine that with, for example, runaway inflation, the fact that soldiers aren't being paid, there'd already been mutinies in the Continental Army, and there would be more. Arnold, I think, he felt that he wasn't alone in feeling that the revolutionary cause had somehow got off target, and that if he led by example, and through some kind of heavy blow, managed to reset the dial, that he would actually be a hero, not only to the British, but there would be men who he'd served alongside who would follow him and see him as a kind of a role model. That probably sounds incredibly naive, but I think that was part of it. He saw himself as, and he's seen as a latter-day General Monk, and it was General Monk who, after the English Civil War in the 1740s, 50s, was instrumental in restoring King Charles II to the throne. So Arnold sees himself as a latter-day monk who will restore George III to his rightful throne in America. And of course, if you do that, you're going to end up getting a lot of prestige and kudos right. from your and reward from your grateful monarch. But right. But Arnold always maintained until his long after it was there was any point in kind of maintaining that argument, that he did what he did in the interests of his countrymen to end the bloodshed and to reunite the fragmented halves of the British Empire.
It's amazing. Now, do you think he was surprised that, or was Clinton surprised that so few other officers followed him? Was there an expectation that Arnold would bring others with him into this?
Yeah, I think there was a feeling that, well, we do know that there were other generals in the Continental Army who were disillusioned. There were certain people the British had identified as potential targets, but it's interesting that they never thought really that Arnold would be one of them. They never approached Arnold. He approached them. And this is the great problem. The great flaw behind the whole West Point plan was the fact that Arnold had such a high reputation as a fighter for the cause of American liberty that the British could never really quite believe that he would come over to them wholeheartedly. They kind of suspected that this might be a double bluff and that the intrepid Arnold just wanted to add another victory on his score sheet by somehow pulling the British into a trap. And this is really why the whole West Point plan unraveled. Mm-hmm. Because Sir Henry Clinton never really knew, because when Arnold approached the British, he of course didn't come to New York in person. He sent an emissary who put forward his case. So the British, and more specifically Clinton's head of intelligence, Captain later Major John Andre, had never met Arnold face to face. They didn't really, all they had was a succession of coded documents pledging various things, passing on intelligence. So somewhere along the line, to really be certain, you had to have a face-to-face meeting with Arnold to establish once and for all that the person you were dealing with really was celebrated patriot hero General Benedict Arnold, and that the aforementioned Benedict Arnold was actually thoroughly sincere in wanting to defect to the British.
So that's the reason why Major Andre finds himself going up the river to meet with Arnold as a way of verifying that Arnold actually is going to do what these messages say he's going to do.
Yeah, I mean, this is basically, just to give a little bit of sort of backstory to it, by the late summer of 1780, the Patriot cause really was in crisis. Although a French expeditionary force had landed at Rhode Island in July, bringing troops and also a fleet, they'd pretty much immediately been bottled up by the British, weren't able to do an awful lot. Washington was always set on the idea of capturing Manhattan, capturing New York from the British, where the British had been since they turfed him out back in 1776. That was always his great idea. And he wanted, when the opportunity arose, to attack New York using the French troops that had arrived to bolster his own understrength forces. Now, the summer of 1780 was very difficult for other reasons. There had been very severe defeats in the South. Charleston had been captured by Sir Henry Clinton, and Charles Cornwallis had actually defeated the Continental Army in the South under Horatio Gates at the Battle of Camden. So this was a real low point for the Patriot cause. And also by this stage, inflation had just gone completely out of control. And so it seemed like kind of this was a good moment to think about administering some kind of knockout blow. And Clinton had always been obsessed about the so-called Hudson Highlands, which is this area of the Hudson River below West Point, where there's a band of mountainous terrain which creates a kind of a choke point. And of course, the Hudson River is the artery running between Canada and New York. It effectively divides the states in two. So whoever controls the Hudson River has a real strategic advantage. West Point is the kind of fort that blocks control of the Hudson River. But Sir Henry Clinton, in the summer of 1777, at the very same time that John Burgoyne was being defeated by Arnold at Saratoga, had quite a major success himself when he captured two forts in the Hudson Valley, just a few miles down from West Point. But he had to evacuate them because of the wider strategic situation, including the loss of Burgoyne's army. But ever since then, he'd always thought, yeah, I know how to take forts. I know that area. You know, it is possible. It's possible to get a force up the Hudson River very quickly from New York because of the very powerful surge tide, the flood tide up the Hudson. You can actually transport large ships in a matter of hours quite high up the river. So in mid-September, 14th September, the strategic situation changed when a British fleet under Sir George British Rodney came into New York, and that comprehensively tipped the balance of sea power against the French, which meant that the French in Rhode Island couldn't really intervene anymore. So the idea of Washington being able to attack New York was completely off the cards. And now, from this point onwards, Sir Henry Clinton started to think, well, hang on, we've got this idea about capturing West Point. We think that Benedict Arnold is the man behind it. Now we finally need to really get the proof we have to have before we can commit our manpower to what could be a very risky operation. And interestingly enough, and this is something which isn't really played up too much, Clinton had already put together a task force of 3,000 men who were going to be sent to Virginia. They were already organized. They had all their ammunition, all their supplies, they were even aboard the transport ships. And so troops were available. They could be sent as soon as the clearance came through. And another factor which was very important was that from an intelligence aspect, Washington's spies, and we've all heard about the Culper spying operating around New York, they all thought that these troops who had been assembled aboard the transport ships were going to Virginia, as indeed they originally were intended to. But Clinton thought, no, we can use these men. We can send these guys up the river as soon as we get clearance that Arnold is who he says he is. So now there was a sudden kind of sense of urgency to get the necessary proof. So various schemes are tried to get this without actually having to physically send Andre up the river. But these, for various reasons, which I guess are all part and parcel of subterfuge, the fact that you can't allow too many people in on the secret, otherwise you blow the secret. So, you know, there was an attempt to meet Arnold at Dobbs Ferry further down the Hudson, but the British guard boats there hadn't been warned. So when they saw Arnold's craft come out in the river, they immediately opened fire on it. And Arnold later said he'd never come as close to being killed in his life. But that scuppered that particular attempt. So eventually, there was no option but to actually send André physically up the river. And he was given a whole list of things he shouldn't do, like carry incriminating papers, go behind enemy lines, and get out of his uniform. Because if you do any of those things, you immediately lay yourself open to a charge of being a spy. And if you're a spy, then you have to face the consequences of what that entails. So André is sent up the river, and he does eventually get to meet Arnold on the early hours of 22nd of September. He goes ashore in Haverstraw Bay, and Arnold and André talk. And of course, we don't have a record of that conversation. We can just piece it together from various things that we know Arnold subsequently told the British. But of course, we don't have André's shorthand notes of what happened, although it would be wonderful if they turned up in an archive somewhere one day. And André then is taken, him and Arnold go off to have breakfast in a nearby house. Whilst they're having breakfast, they hear the sound of a bombardment. Oh, what's going on? And it turns out that the ship that André had come up the Hudson in, and which was destined to take him back down to safety, HMS Vulture, had come under fire from a colonel, James Livingston, who just completely on his own authority decided he didn't like having that British sloop hanging around within range of his guns, and without authority from Arnold or anyone else, opened fire, forced it to drop anchor to fall down the Hudson to Sing Sing. Now, this meant that André couldn't get back to New York the way he'd come by the river. He'd have to get back another way. And it was decided by Joshua Hett Smith, who was kind of a rather shadowy figure, but who Arnold was using as a go-between and who had been entrusted with the care of André, that Smith would take André back to New York by land. They would cross the Hudson at King's Ferry and then go down the east side of the Hudson back to New York. And it was going back by land through this kind of no man's land between the Patriot and British zones of influence was far riskier than going down the Hudson in a British man of war capable of fending off any other vessel that was on the river. And it's while André is making this perilous journey, he's almost home and dry when Joshua Hett Smith says, "Oh, actually, you're on your own from now on. I'm going to turn back," just when he was most needed. And André had to go on his own, and he hadn't gone too far when he was intercepted by a trio of kind of freelance militiamen, if you want to call them that, who there's a big debate over exactly what they were. But they stopped André, and they liked the look of him because he was well dressed, he was wearing a pair of fancy boots, he was riding a good horse, and they decided to halt him. And André, as these militiamen themselves later said, if he'd actually produced the pass that Arnold had written for him, they said they would have let him through. But with a kind of a momentary loss of nerve, André blustered out, which party do you belong to? And all this. And they started to ask questions. He revealed the fact that he was a British officer. And it turned out that his notion that they were, in fact, must be loyalists was wrong. And they weren't. So they now thoroughly, with their suspicions thoroughly aroused, got him down off his horse, strip searched him, eventually found documents that Arnold had given him completely unnecessarily stashed inside his stockings. And then they realized the penny dropped. Okay, we've got a spy here. This is very suspicious. And they turned him in to the local commander.
There was an inclination to send him to Arnold because Arnold was the commander in this area, which certainly would have change things?
Well, it's a very interesting story because Colonel Jameson, who was the local commander, and it was interesting to find out he was actually related to the Jameson, the whiskey producers in Dublin.
Wow.
He seems to have been a bit flummoxed because Andre was using the name John Anderson, and Arnold had already written to Jameson saying, "I'm expecting a John Anderson." So when John Anderson turned up, Jameson couldn't really, wasn't quite sure. He said, "Well, hang on, this is the guy that General Arnold is expecting. So let's listen to what he has to say," even though he's carrying incriminating documents written in Arnold's own hand. Something about the situation made Jameson hesitant. So he sent word to Arnold that they had apprehended John Anderson. And at the same time, he sent the documents found on Anderson Andre to George Washington. And of course, George Washington at this time was coming back from Hartford, Connecticut, where he had been in conference with the French. No one really knew where he was, which road he was taking. So because of Jameson's kind of doubt about the situation, you have this bizarre scenario where you have two different messengers going off with two different sets of information to different people. Who's going to get there first? And we know from another letter that Jameson wrote that Andre had actually tried to persuade Jameson to send him to Arnold. So Andre was thinking on his feet by that stage, having loused things up earlier on. And if Jameson had sent Andre to Arnold, then of course the plot would never have been discovered. And as it was only discovered by, again, another extraordinary sequence of events, because Andre is arrested on the 23rd of September. 24th of September, there's a kind of a hiatus where nobody really knows what's going on. 25th of September, this is the day that Arnold, who's got a headquarters close to West Point on the opposite bank of the river, he's expecting George Washington to come and join him for breakfast that morning. Shortly before, literally an hour or half an hour before Washington joins him for breakfast, the first dispatch rider that Jameson had sent with notification that John Anderson had been captured reaches Arnold's headquarters, hands over his dispatch. Arnold quietly reads it, and you can imagine what he must have felt. He knew that, okay, the game's up, but it gave him the opportunity to get away. And so he rode his horse down to the river. And at this stage, light dragoons from Washington's own party are already turning up at the Robinson House where Arnold is based. And he bluffs his way past them, rides down to the river. Luckily, his personal barge is there, and he gets his bargeman to row him down the river, ultimately down to the Vulture. Half an hour later, Washington turns up and is told that Arnold is over at West Point. So he goes over to West Point, but Arnold's nowhere to be found. Eventually, having made a tour of inspection, seen how dilapidated the defences of West Point have become, and starting to feel rather uneasy, Washington returns, still no sign of Arnold. Shortly afterwards, Jameson's second messenger turns up with the big bunch of documents written in Arnold's own hand, giving the plans of West Point, all the details of how the British can take it. Then suddenly the penny drops. And this is when, if he ever said it, Washington comes out with his line of, "Who can we trust now?"
Yeah.
It's an incredible story. And the timing of the events, you really couldn't make it up.
No, you couldn't. It really is a terrific story. We're talking with Stephen Brumwell, the author of Turncoat, Benedict Arnold and the Crisis of American Liberty. And I recommend the book. It really is the definitive look at this entire episode, as well as Arnold's career before and his career afterwards. So thank you so much for joining us, Stephen.
Well, thank you very much, Bob, and thank you for having such interesting questions, which allowed me to actually get across the key points in my book. So thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you. And well, and thank you to Jonathan Lane, our producer, and to Doug Quigley and the Emmerichs, who will pipe us out with The Road to Boston. So thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.